RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
My guest today is a man who has helped shape the world of branding. By that I don't mean simply designing a logo or stationery range, but corporate identity at its most thorough. It is about the total personality of an organization, what it does, how it behaves and communicates to its customers and various audiences in all its manifestations. His name is Michael Wolff, who, along with Wally Olins, founded the design consultancy Wolff Olins in 1965. But Wolff left that company almost three decades ago to pursue his own unique take on the world of design through advising companies, government bodies, and giving inspirational talks around the world. Wolff has a view on the use and effectiveness of design in this 21st century. Join me now to hear that view. I spoke to him at his home in London's Islington. Let's start by explaining to listeners what branding is, because there's always confusion about what it is, and it's used by government now and on the radio and so forth, and everyone seems to be a brand, people are a brand. So what's your take on branding?
Well, I'll tell you a little story, but before I do, I want to give you a quotation by Maya Angelou, which I think in a way sums it up. And she said, "People will forget what you say, people will forget what you do, but they will always remember how you made them feel." And in a way, that is the essence of branding, because although it started with being burning a mark in a cow's behind so that if the car was stolen, you could claim it back, it was my cow, that was how it started, that's why it's called branding, it then sort of morphed into, well, I made this, so I'll rather like branding a cow's bum, I'll put my badge on the front of the car that I made, because I'm Henry Ford, and all my cars are going to be called Fords. And I made these razor blades, they were going to be called Gillettes. And I designed this dress, and they were going to be called Dior. And of course, it started to change because these people died, and what they made changed. And, you know, the designers who stood on their shoulders and moved it forward were either better than them or more likely not as good as them, not as charismatic. And business started to emasculate talent, which it often does. And then I think what happened was it moved into a more neurological thing, which is that a brand is really the way you decide why you're attracted to something. So I think of them really as files in your brain. So if you are interested in cars, for example, and you like Audi cars, for example, you will put all the things that you appreciate about Audi, most of which are invented by you, by the way, and they will send you certain signals and it will look a certain way and behave a certain way. But we make the brands that we put in our minds, and the companies that want us to put them there support us by the way they behave and the products that they make and how they write and how they, all the rest of it. But you add a lot of things. One very interesting little story, which is not original, and that is that if you go into a supermarket that you have in your mind as a brand that you cherish and the product that you want isn't there, you blame yourself for being late. And if you go into a supermarket that you despise and that you don't hold in your brain as a brand that you favour, you'll curse them for not having stuff in stock. So, you know, you change your attitude. And if it's a brand that you love, you forgive it all sorts of things. And then if you don't like it for some reason, or it lets you down, or somebody's more attractive, you chuck it out of your mind and you replace it with another file. It's more or less how it works, Mike.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, let's wind back now to your childhood. Your parents were Russian.
They came
from St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And you were born here in the 1930s in London. Tell me a little bit about your parents.
33, you're not quite that old. My parents, well, my father was a man with a very dominant brother. So when my father came here, his brother was already living here and was an international barrister and a very Dickensian character. I mean, he was very formal. He lived in Belsize Park. He had a waistcoat. I think they called them three-piece suits and a tie. And he was immaculately dressed until he was 98 or 99, I think he was, when he died. He was very formal, great twinkle in his eye, a great atheist. although he knew the metropolitan who ran the Russian church here. And his daughter was a very, very religious, and she still is actually, member of the Russian Orthodox Church. He despised religion. And my father was very dominated by this man. A much more modest character, my father, much more aesthetic character, much more unclear who he was. And he became a monitor during the war. That's to say, he listened to broadcasts in Russia, translated them for the BBC, or for the nation, really. And after the war, he became a simultaneous interpreter, which was a job that I hadn't really understood what a talent it took, you know, until I experienced simultaneous interpretation myself. It's an amazing talent, because they know what you're saying as you're saying it, and say it in the same way in another language. So he was very bright. My mother, on the other hand, also very bright, looked like Greta Garbo. If I look at pictures of her in Russia, sitting in a Victorian dining room where her parents, her father was a timber merchant or something, they were quite grand, she looked as if she's been retouched in by Photoshop. She looks like a film star. And she was a very tough piece of work, actually. So she ran my father and my stepfather while I was away in boarding school.
So it was a fairly middle-class background that you came from,
I suppose that's probably true.
So you were evacuated, but mostly at boarding schools.
I was in my first boarding school at 5.
When you were 5, yes.
It was grim. I mean, he was smacked for taking... You were allowed 5 sweets, and if you took 6, you got beaten about quite a bit. I mean, it was very strict. Oh, I loathed every school I went to.
And you went to rather a lot?
I went to probably 5 of them. And I ended up in Gresham's, which is a minor concentration camp.
There you are at Gresham Public School.
Yeah.
Probably around about the age of, 16,
17? Yes. Ran away twice.
Ran away twice.
Yes.
So you ended up spending a year in France at around about the age of 17. And
yes.
You became very passionate about church architecture over there. Tell me a little
bit about
that.
Well, it wasn't so much about churches, Mike. It was about massive buildings of extraordinary beauty. And for me, it was... I remember one occasion sleeping in a tent, which was a triangular tent. And at one end, when I woke up, near Chartres, there was a cow's head looking at me. And the other end was Chartres Cathedral in the sunrise. And I've never forgotten that image. And we drove towards Chartres. Of course, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But, I mean, the immensity of these buildings and the significance of these buildings and the beauty and the craftsmanship in these buildings. I wasn't particularly interested in the religious aspect of these buildings, but that they were standing there. I'm still amazed by cathedrals, really. I think they're quite astounding, most of them.
Well, when you got back, that interest sort of obviously clearly took you along to the Architectural Association school, where you, for a time, studied architecture. But that didn't last very long.
A couple of years I did that, but I spent most of my time really in cinemas. I was totally fascinated by the talent and beauty and the way that films move you. You know, I'm still like that, really. I mean, I just think cinema is an extraordinary medium. And architecture struck me as being a humourless activity, very little wit in architecture. And I think humour has always been a very strong part of me, and I didn't find it amongst the rather earnest creatures who become architects.
So you were really biding your time, I guess, because, you know, national service loomed large for
it
most
did.
18-year-olds
yeah.
in this country,
yeah.
right up until the 60s. You had to do a statutory 2 years
yeah.
national service, and that's exactly what you did.
Well, I deferred it for quite a long time.
Oh, you managed to...
I managed to defer it because of being a student.
Yeah.
And then, I can't remember actually the technicality of it, but I got caught because I left the AA.
Yeah.
I met this wonderful man called Henry Elder, and he asked me, what do I really want to do? Well, I didn't really know, but so I said dress design because I was fascinated by it, because I was a teddy boy, actually. And so I was interested in clothes anyway. And also interested in why men's clothes weren't as interesting as women's clothes. I studied dress design and welding, which I just love the smell and the flames and the metal of it. And interior design at Hammersmith, because there was a chap at the AA, Henry Elder, who was deputy principal, I think. And he was one of the first people who actually thought I was talented, which was quite a relief. So I went there.
Into what he sort of pinpointed the fact that you had a creative spirit. And
he thought I was obviously a person with creative capacity.
Yeah.
And in the transition between the AA and Hammersmith, I got called up and I couldn't do anything about it. So I went into the army, had a horrible time, but managed to get out, which is another story because I was extremely skillful in getting out.
Well, when you eventually left,
yeah,
you got yourself a job at Olympia,
yeah,
working on exhibition stands,
yes,
and that led to a string of sort of short-term,
yeah,
jobs,
yeah,
which it then connected on to the world of advertising, Crawford's advertising.
Crawford, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about your
tell you that between designing exhibition stands, where I knew I was unlike other designers designing exhibition stands, I knew that I had a stronger wit, I think, probably, and a stronger, probably, intelligence. It sounds very arrogant in the way that I did it. So I went from there, and I was rejected from there. I was sacked about 10 times, but I did exhibition stands, I designed nightclubs, I designed light fittings, and I went from company to company to company pretty quickly. And being out of kilter with what the people I worked for seemed to want, until I arrived at Crawford's, where a guy called Jack Foxall, who was the creative director of their bit of their business that did designing, really understood what I was trying to do, even better than I did, actually. And I spent 3 years there and began to understand the kind of designer I was going to become. I mean, he was enormously important for me because, you know, appreciation, it just lets you understand what it is you are, which if you don't have appreciation, it's very hard to know what you are.
Mm. You then, I think, moved on to the BBC.
Yeah.
Working on set design.
I did set design at the BBC for a year with Natasha Crull.
Right.
And didn't enjoy that very much.
You kind of moved sort of into, whether you moved into it, but it certainly excited you, the graphics department at the BBC.
Yeah, my first graphic job was designing a cover for the Muckshifter and Spreader, which enabled me to discover Cooper Black as a very sort of...
What has that got to do with the BBC? Sorry.
Sorry?
What's that got to do with the BBC?
Oh, I left the BBC.
Oh, you left?
Yeah, yeah. I had a 3-year contract, and I found that the set design didn't give you enough creative scope.
Right.
It was very frustrating, actually.
So then you were freelancing after the BBC?
Then I became a freelance, yeah.
Okay. And you were doing editorial work?
I then got this wonderful job working for a group that ran magazines. And as I say, I designed the cover of Muckshifter and Spreader and discovered Cooper Black.
Right.
And then discovered the wonder of type, the
yes.
joy, the beauty, the incredible variation of typefaces.
And, of course, its personality, which...
Oh.
So a lot of... A
well,
lot
I'm of... still completely amazed by type.
Yes.
And then, of course, it was metal.
Yeah.
And but still had been cut, and it was just, I mean, type is the most amazing thing. And at the same time, you discover the miracle of a language, really. And it's just...
Yes, I want to go on to language and words a little bit later. But while you were freelancing,
yeah.
You saved up enough money to buy yourself a Citroën DS.
You know more about me than I do, yeah.
And that led you, you know, your love of sort of French, rather eccentric
I would
design.
Say it was chapter 2 of Francophilia.
Yeah.
Because at the AA, I spent most of my time looking at French movies. And so I wore black shirts and I smoked Gauloises and I, you know, I thought everything French was miraculous. And so when I saved up the money and got a DS, which I still think is the most beautiful car ever, ever produced, it was such a joy. Oh, what a beautiful thing.
It is, they're beautiful cars. There you are with your French car. A little later, you join James Main.
Yes.
Who had spotted you as a bit of a talent.
Yeah, I've no idea how he did that, but he did that.
And you started to get rather interested in a sort of deeper approach to, as it was called then, corporate identity.
Yes.
And at the same time, Wally Ullins joins the company.
No, he came after. He came after. What happened, the story is that I joined James and it was called Main Wolf and Partners.
Right.
And then James's children went to school with Wally's children. Wally was running a design company called Caps. Wally's idea of creative direction, because he wasn't a particularly creative person, was a guy called Ernest Hock, for whom international paper sizes seemed to be the epitome of graphic design. So he was Wally's an extremely bright guy. He was pretty much tortured by this international paper size, as if that was the absolute embodiment of all graphic design. Meanwhile, I was working with James, and we were doing some quite strange and interesting work. And when Wally and I met, I think we both recognised in each other a reservoir of talents which we actually lacked in ourselves. So he was wise and worldly, and I wasn't to do with international paper sizes.
So you kind of complemented each other.
We completely complemented each other, yeah.
So Wolf Ullins.
It was Main Wolf Ullins.
Yeah.
And then James left.
Okay.
And then it was Wally and me, really.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Wolf Ullins, because I guess, thinking back at that time when Wolf Ullins started, generally in the design world, it was still a time of, you know, modernist, clinical.
Yes.
You talked about international paper sizes, and that sort of sums it up. It was the clinical graphic symbols.
Yes, a lot of Swiss
clean
influence.
Swiss design.
Ulm and all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. Which was said a lot more about the designers imposing a style. Yes. Rather than embracing the problem and reflecting the client or their product or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But you at Wolf Ullins, you know, sort of really cut right through this. And a lot of your work at that time used animals, and you've mentioned animals quite a lot already in these interviews, you know, seeing the cow and the big building and so forth. You used animals to express an organisation. For example, you used a hummingbird for the construction company Bovis. You used a fox for a paint company.
Yeah.
You used a cockney sparrow for the London Borough of Southwark and so on.
Yeah.
And this kind of harps back to, I suppose, turn of the century advertising, where they use creatures, not necessarily in a sophisticated way as you were doing, you're invoking an idea.
Well, his master's voice was a wonderful one, of course.
Exactly. So it was sort of bringing a kind of humanity back into design that had sort of been lacking for probably 20 years. I mean, it was...
Well, I remember seeing this wonderful little piece of wrapping around a sweet, which was a mint, and it was called Fox's Glacier Mint, and it had a bear on it. And I thought, you know, this is not only surreal, it's beautiful, and it's entertaining, and and it makes you want to eat the glacier mints. I mean, the idea of calling them glacier mints was wonderful anyway. I was just interested. I think, Mike, we were populists and our competitors were elitists, probably.
Yes, yes.
And that was a lot of commercial design, which was crap.
Yes.
But of the design that you took seriously, there was elitist design, which was all about purity and classic. And I don't know how to describe it because I don't quite know what it is. But I always respected it.
Yeah.
But we were about populist design and yeah, we were populists.
I want to talk a little bit about how you actually work, because I think linking it back to your time in advertising at Crawford's, it seems to me that you developed more like an advertising art director in that at that time, designers tended to be self-contained people.
Yeah.
They would do everything themselves. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking of the Alan Fletchers, the David Gentlemans, who would be a kind of one-stop.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You, on the other hand, had always worked collaboratively, or you were more of a creative conductor, or you pulled elements together. You would have a thought process, and you would bring others in to extend the idea.
Yeah.
And you seem to have worked that way ever since.
It's true.
A kind of creative conductor. And also, you, unusually, I think, for designers, you also had a love of words, and we talked a little bit earlier about words.
Yeah.
Very much in the spirit of, say, Bill Birnbach,
The
American copywriter who brought wit into advertising copywriting with everyday speech. Yeah. And I know that that's something that you, even now, are always trying to get into copy. And we'll talk about that a little later. So there you are at Wolf Ullins. the company prospers, expands, and you travel a lot,
yeah.
a lot all over the place, in the US in particular.
Yeah.
And while you were in the US, you got involved with an organization called the Erhard Seminar Training, which is a kind of self-discovery cult. It was a yes. cult at the time. There was a lot of this around.
Yeah.
And I read that you said that the experience actually changed your life. So maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about that and
yes.
what you meant by that.
I think what I meant by that was that I really discovered who I was through that. And it was an extraordinary... I don't think it was a cult, by the way. I think it was just an extraordinarily well-designed course, really introducing you to the nowness of now, if you like, and to the you-ness of you. And I realized that there was an actor version of me, which was something that I used quite a lot, but there was also an authentic me within that. And during this 2 weekends, I was able to come to terms with who I really was, I think. And it was an extraordinary, extraordinary experience.
Am I right in thinking that this particular setup, which EST for short,
yeah.
is a kind of 3-day
It was a two-weekend affair.
Where you're kind of locked into a room,
no.
you can't pee and all that sort
no,
of
no,
stuff.
No, 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 no.
That's
no.
not right. That's what
no.
I've read.
No.
I read that it...
No, no, no. What there was if people get uncomfortable, the first resort is probably to go out of the room and take a leak or something. So what they would say to you is, if unless you've got a really medical reason to get up and leave the room, which, of course, if you have, you can... But if you're just feeling uncomfortable and want to go and leave the room, it's probably not a good idea because you're going to disturb everybody. So you were encouraged not to get up and leave because some of these processes were quite deep. It was a good thing that you just sat there and watched other people go through things and go through things yourself. But it was nothing weird about it. It was a mixture of bits of psychology, bits of cobbled together stuff. But I found it incredibly useful.
Mm.
And I still, you know, thank whoever it is, the universe or whatever, that I did it, because it just let me understand much more about who I was and how I related to other people and what was going on.
Okay, so you then have this new kind of
yeah.
force, energy, whatever you want to
yeah.
call it, and you come back to Orphelins and you...
Yeah.
How does it affect your relationship there? Do you put any of that thinking into practice?
Well, I think I did, but I think I may have been a bit of a zealot because it was such a transformation for me that I think it probably was irritating to some people, because I went through, I suppose, years of therapy in 2 weekends. And so I came back more myself than I'd been, as far as I was concerned, for them, a slightly different person to the one they thought I was. So I was more penetrating, in a sense, about what I was doing and what we were doing. I was more critical of our habits. I was more concerned that our work was of value beyond just the commercial value of what it was purporting to do. It made me deeper, and it stayed with me, actually, till today. You know, I'm as interested in why people run their businesses and what the businesses are about as I am in how they look, really. And that started then. And I had to carry people with me. And mm-hmm. some I did and some I didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, towards the early 90s, you parted company
yeah.
with Warfare.
Yes.
Yeah. Was that a difficult thing to do?
It was a very difficult thing to do. And I think, basically, you know, when something of that sort of order happens to anyone, you try and look at yourself through the telescope at which they're looking at you. And I think what happened is that they were, when I say they, my three co-directors, were trying to focus the business down into what it did that created an effective business. I was continuing to open it out into what it needed to be an effective business from the way I saw it. So I think they were centripetal in their attitude. I was centrifugal.
Right.
And they found me difficult in relation to what they were doing. And to be honest, I was, because they were evolving into a kind of process. Stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, out the door. I was evolving into, what are we doing? Why does it work? Why doesn't it work? What is it about it? And I was always dissatisfied with anything that we've arrived at as a way of working. I always thought, no, once we're stuck with this, we're stuck with that, we've got to move on. And I think I must have been very tiring for people. I think I still am quite
interesting
tiring.
Interesting you should say that, because the very thing you sort of rejected when you started was this looking for a different way of expressing things, away from the structured Swiss in a box sort of style. So that seemed to be consistent with you. So after you leave Wolf Olins, you have a series of jobs. I mean, it starts with you formed the Consortium, which is kind of loose creative collective. That lasted for
It was very interesting, actually. It didn't need to last longer than it lasted. But it was, I think this thing of, you know, building a company and sticking with it forever is one way of living. But I think it's like, you know, moving from one country to another is another way of living. And I just moved from one situation to another situation to another situation.
Yes, so you went to Addison.
Addison was very interesting.
Tell me a little bit about Addison, because this was at a time when I think within the, you know, design fraternity, there were lots of companies being bought up by agencies or going on the unlisted securities stock market, and it was all becoming business very much business.
And that, in a way, if you don't mind me going back for a moment, to me, the two most creative things that I think I made happen in Wolf Olins, I think that our food, which was never designed to show off, but was designed to show, look, you can choose. I think in many ways our food was more creative than our work. And there was one thing which I'm most proud of when I look back at it, was we gave a Christmas party. We used to have Christmas parties where clients used to come with a lot of alcohol, typical corporate business party, pretty repugnant, actually. And I thought, well, the spirit of Christmas, what can we do that's different? And I went to Camden and we got 30 young kids, 6, 7, 8, who had nowhere to go for Christmas. And we got 30 of those. We got 30 elderly people who were living on their own, nowhere to go for Christmas. Camden were fantastic. They produced these people. We had 60 people, a mixture of 7, 8, 9-year-olds and 75, 80 to 90-year-olds. And the company spent 2 weeks making gifts. We had this great central staircase. We had this wonderful guy called Uncle Bob, who was our carpenter. It was a lovely, lovely Bob Mayo, Irishman, beautiful, lovely guy. We dressed him up as Santa. We got snow machine. We had wonderful Christmas carols. And Uncle Bob came down this central atrium with the sack over his shoulder with Christmas carols and snow falling. And for me, that was as good a Christmas as I... It was like something when I was 6 or 7. To me, that was one of the most successful things we ever did. It was just for us, and it was for those 60 people. But if I try and remember, what did we do that was valuable to other human beings? That was one of the high points for me. And of course, it wasn't for them, in retrospect. But it was just wonderful. And when I went to Addison, I tried to get Paula Pryke to be our reception area with the flower shop. But I then immediately bumped into the corporate aspect of Addison, which, I mean, on the one hand, I have to thank them because they said to me, use this company as a palette, paint on it, lead this company. And I had a few years there where we went from nothing to, I think, pretty much challenging Wolf Olins. We became quite a vigorous company, and then it lost its way, and I left.
You in 92, you took over from Dick Guyatt. As the external design advisor to W.H. Smith.
I did.
If I remember rightly, it was a very, very pleasurable time.
Oh, that was 10 years of sheer joy.
Because you had a client who recognised what design could do and the importance of design.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think the relationship between design and client is often undervalued.
Yeah. Well, Simon Hornby was, and Malcolm Field, but Simon Hornby in particular, he was the most amazing client. Because he understood noise, he understood language. I had a private language with him. He noticed everything, and he knew the value of everything, in even the most trivial things. I think without that 10 years with him, I wouldn't be what I am today. I mean, he was whatever it is I am today. But he was an extraordinary partner, and he was running a very successful business. So for me, it was probably the peak of my educational experiences, really. Mm. He was a wonderful teacher.
It was a very good time for W. H. Smith. It
yeah.
was a pleasure to visit their stores. You must be very depressed when you go into a W. H. Oh. Smith today.
Oh, it's very sad.
All of that is gone. The whole
very sad. Yeah.
You then became non-executive at Newell and Sorrow.
Yes.
And helped them along with their
yeah.
and influenced them obviously. And I think one of the things that's clearly very much your influence was Nice Day.
Yes.
Nice Day products.
Charlie Barsotti, the cartoonist.
Little dog and another little animal pops up. And then eventually in the late 90s, you start yet another company, The Fourth Room.
Yeah.
And in fact, around about that time, I had interviewed you, and I remember you saying, I think you were 4 years into that company, and you were saying that that company, you described it as the first real radical company, and you were very excited
yeah.
about what was about to
yeah.
happen.
Yeah.
Well, what happened a little later is that
It
disappeared. What happened?
Well, it was a fantasy, really. And it was a glorious fantasy. It was like a chapter in one's life, you know. It was great fun. We did some wonderful work, but it wasn't a sensible business. It was a great idea, and it was a rotten business, really. It didn't work as a business.
I think, if I remember, the idea was that you didn't actually do any of the creative work. It
yeah.
was really thinking and bringing
yeah.
others in. So
yeah.
it was a sort of your earlier thinking sort of made into a company.
Yeah, I suppose so. But it was, and it was, Wendy Gordon was there, who's a wonderful, I mean, she's the queen of qualitative research, and she's still a wonderful leader in her field. But, you know, she'd run companies and didn't want to run it. I'd kind of led companies and didn't want to lead it. And so the people who did lead it didn't, we thought, well, that was going to be fine. We'd be able to have a wonderful time doing what we're good at, but it didn't quite work out that way. But it was fun.
Well, after that company faded away, you've ever since that time, you've very much operated under your own name, helping organizations
yes.
express themselves.
Yeah.
And I think going back to where we opened up, which was, what, you know, what is branding? The sort of relationships I think you have with organizations, or certainly the ones that I think you try to engender, is an honesty
yeah.
in reflecting what an organization mm-hmm. is. And I think that to do that, it takes a lot of bravery on the part of the client.
It does.
Because so many clients, or so many organizations, and I'm thinking of, you know, the Thatcher years, where companies were dressed up, basically,
yeah, yeah.
you know, to sell off.
Well, they're just there to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how have you found, you know, in the last decade, your working relationship with various clients that you've
yeah.
helped? Has
okay.
it been difficult? Have you found those sort of
well,
clients that are willing to reveal themselves? And
yeah, I think, you know, to be honest, I've had successes and failures, you know, and some of the successes are due to the fact that the companies were willing and interested and questioning about why they're there. You see, the truth, Mike, is that I never work for organisations, I work for individual people. And now I'm beginning to start to work with groups of people, which is completely new for me, and I'm really enjoying it. But it's the same thing, though. You work with the human being. You don't work with the institution. Institutions shut down at night. The buildings are empty. Offices are empty. Businesses stop, most of them. Some have shifts that go on, and some are in different time zones and all the rest of it. And so, you know, some very big companies around the world, there's something happening all the time. But on the whole, it's the people that count. Why are the people there? And so often you find people in companies who don't really know what the companies are for, why they exist. It's just a job. And you don't want to belittle people for that. Of course you don't, because we all work for different reasons. But on the whole, when you're dealing with people who lead significant enterprises, you want to feel they know the value that they bring to the world, and not just the value that they bring to themselves. And so on the whole, come back to centripetal, centrifugal. If there is a certain amount of centrifugal energy in a company, then I can be very useful to them. If they're entirely centripetal, then they probably don't need to work with somebody like me.
You've now, I mean, we're coming to the end of this, to kind of round things up a little. You're now in your 70s.
Yeah.
You've had a career spanning, what, over 50 years.
Probably.
Most people would be winding down or even retired by now. You carry on. Why? Is my first question. Why carry on, you know, when you, I guess, you could change your life and quietly write or reflect on all those years of experience?
Well, you know what? For me, the most important thing in life is to be useful, really, and to be loving. But if I don't find that I'm being useful or doing something of value to other people, I get scared. You know, I don't like to feel useless. I don't like to feel I'm not doing something that helps other people in some way. And so, you know, I do quite a lot of stuff which I hope is helpful, which is not business-like. It's not rewarded financially. But I'm passionate about it. I love what design is,
Well, let's dwell on that a little bit in terms of design. So what issues concern you about design in the 21st century? So let's take one topic. So
yeah.
What about, design and the aging population?
Yeah, well, that concerns me a lot. You know, when you know that what we call dementia, that concerns me that it's called dementia. You know, what a ridiculous name. It makes young people think that older people are mad. Dementia, demented. It's no coincidence that that name has happened. It's one of those names like spastic or educationally subnormal, which is inappropriate, inaccurate, and stupid. How do you change a name like that? And I know professors of neurology in universities around the place who always say to me, "Oh God, it is a dreadful name. How are we going to change it? I don't know how we're going to change it." But when I hear that there are more people suffering from these neurological degenerative diseases than heart attacks and cancer and strokes put together, and we're in denial about it, I get very exercised about it. And especially as I'm now in the generation of people that are approaching the end of their lives, you know, I mean, I don't know how long I'm going to live, and I see how we're treated and how, you know, old people in care homes are treated. I just cannot believe, you know, I know plenty of people in the UK who will say, how can they stone women for adultery? And we will be appalled by it. And of course, it's utterly unacceptable, totally appalling, and has to be changed. But we're doing terrible things too. We're doing terrible things to people who we don't want in our homes anymore, who are old people who go into care homes, where equally appalling things happen, actually. So our tolerance of cruelty, of callousness, of carelessness is extraordinarily high, and I feel driven in a way to make a noise about that, but to make a practical noise about that, to try and change it.
You talked a little bit there at the beginning, dementia language, which is something that I know you've corporate language, corporate gobbledygook, hospital language, medical language. I remember you saying a long time ago, why can't they call cancer rather than
oncology
which is kind of like a foreign language.
Yeah.
Obviously, the medical profession and the legal profession both suffer from the same thing, which is impenetrable language to keep people out so that they don't understand.
No.
And I know that that's something that's exercised
that
you a lot.
Totally obsesses me. I mean, I just find it so baffling. You know, why are people called oncologists? Why is it called renal? Why do when you go to the hospital, you're confronted with all this stuff? I mean, there's a very interesting thing about hospitals. They don't ask you what you want to be called. They don't ask you, give us a sentence that if you're going to be an inpatient for more than 3 or 4 days, what can we know about you? So, in fact, when a doctor walks around a hospital ward, he'll probably refer to the patients by the name of what's wrong with them. Because there's a couple of coronaries there. There's a spina bifida. I don't remember these awful medical names. There's an emphysema. There's two emphysemas. But if it said, I'm a cab driver, and I've been driving a cab for 30 years, or I love playing snooker or something, and my name is Ted so-and-so. And equally, I'd like to see what the doctors call. I mean, can't be difficult to put labels on people.
It is extraordinary that even today in the 21st century, the so-called bedside manner is still not top of the list.
It's ridiculous.
You hear, you know, consultants having to go to lessons to be able to talk to their patients because they've never had to do that sort of thing.
Or to cope with someone who burst into tears.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know there are lots of other things that drive you mad. Dishonesty, pomposity,
well,
bad service. Well,
they drive me mad. They're just jobs to be done, Mike.
So tell me now, in terms of you as a designer today, I'm a client, what do you bring to
what
the
What I bring to you?
Yeah, what would you bring to me?
Well, what I'll bring to you, I think, is I will reconnect you with why you're in the business you're in. You may have forgotten. You may have got lazy about it. So I will try and find out what it was that drove you to do what you do and what you want to be remembered for. Why are you in this business? And when we wake that up again, we then say, well, how do you express yourself in a way that people will know that that's why you're in that business? How do we connect with the impression you want to give other people with who you are and why you're doing it? So in the end, it's actually about coherence. It's about the way that you express yourself will reveal who you are rather than tell some sort of story that's been built up by other people. And that's what I think I try to do.
We're now sort of delivering design, to use a kind of corporate phrase,
We even talk about delivering visions.
Platforms, whatever.
Yeah.
But we're living in a dramatically different era from when you started way back, when everything was analog.
Yeah.
I mean, everything is now digital, you know, design is...
Everything's online.
Everything's online. You know, people don't actually see one another much anymore. It can all be sent via the internet, via PDFs and so forth. But thinking is still the most important thing. You know, it's the thought, not the execution, although the execution is clearly important.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about younger designers now getting into a very overcrowded business, increasingly so. Do you have any thoughts?
I do, actually. And the main thought I have is don't think that a design company is where designers should necessarily be. Because if you're interested in creativity and you are creative and you can see and you have got curiosity and you do appreciate things and you have got imagination, take it anywhere. Go and work in any company. You know, go and bring it to anyone who will listen to you. Go and start a shoe shop. Go and work. I mean, it's not... The design company is not the only place to be a designer. In fact, it's actually, in some ways, rather a constraining place to be a designer. Go and be a designer somewhere where they want a designer.
Well, that's a great thought. Michael Wolff, thank you.
Well, thank you.